We've now travelled halfway across the vast expanses of the State Library, from its glittering glass atrium to the gloomy and mysterious older parts, where we're sitting in a tiny little library full of very ancient books with a very small audience who wanted to come along and put some questions to Brian Gensler. He's an award-winning astronomer, author, science communicator, Young Australian of the Year, NASA Hubble Fellow, etc. By all accounts, a remarkably gifted young scientist. And I am going to start the ball rolling by putting to you the question he avoided when it was posed by my previous guest. So here goes. Brian, why is it that you are dismissive of the whole notion of string theory? Why is it that you're not willing to get dragged into a discussion about multiple dimensions or parallel universes?
Well, science, the paradigm of science that's we've followed for thousands of years, rightly or wrongly, is that science is supposedly driven by theories that make predictions, which can be confirmed or refuted, and observations which aren't explained by any of our current theories and then have to have theories that try and explain them. So, for example, Albert Einstein came up with his theory of special relativity. It was totally out there. No one had foreseen a need for this, but it predicted that during a solar eclipse, the positions of the stars would shift very slightly. Now, it's hard to believe that Einstein was a complete nobody after he published his special theory of relativity until a bunch of other astronomers went on expeditions to observe solar eclipses in 1919. The shift of the stars was exactly as Einstein predicted, and he instantly became the celebrity that we're familiar with today. But until his theory was proven right, he was no different from any other crazy person with a theory. The problem with string theory is that it doesn't make any predictions, none that can actually be measured. So imagine if Einstein had been churning out theory after theory, but there was no way to know whether he was right or crazy. Well, no one would be heralding Einstein as a genius, no one would even know his name. And that's where string theory is at, that it is unable to make any predictions that anyone can ever test. And for that reason, it's a very nice theory, but there are lots of theories out there that are nice.
The maths are very elegant.
The maths is very elegant. Yeah, it's a beautiful theory, but it's only a theory. And most physicists don't really have much time or interest in theories that can't be tested, because there are many other theories out there that can't be tested either. And there's no point discussing them unless you know how to decide which one is right.
Thrilled to bits about Schmidt's Nobel?
Oh, look, I fell off my chair when it was announced. So Brian Schmidt, as you know, won the Nobel Prize for Physics last year, only the second Nobel Prize for Physics that's gone to an Australian. Brian is someone who's very well known in the astronomical community in Australia. I work very closely with him and talk to him all the time. And every year on this date, we make fun of him and tease him and say, is this the year? So last year, I actually emailed him on the day they were announcing it saying, are you going to get a phone call tonight? And he wrote back saying, if I do, just shoot me because it will be the end of my scientific productivity. This year, I was actually on a teleconference with him and many other people that on a Tuesday afternoon. And he said, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to step out for about an hour and I'll be back a bit later. And we all, after he got off the phone, we all said jokingly, oh, I bet you he's taking the phone call from Sweden right now, and that's why he had to step out of the conference. So it was quite a delight but a big shock when about 5 hours later, the same day we were just talking about mundane nuts and bolts of keeping Australian astronomy going, that he got the announcement. And so it's great news for Australia, but I think we've unleashed, well, the Nobel Committee have unleashed a force of nature, and that if you get Brian over a beer or a wine, he will be quite expansive on how he would change things in Australia if he was in charge. And now I guess in some sense he is in charge. He has a lot of clout, and I expect you'll be seeing a lot of opinions from Brian on ways that we can do science better, how we can educate people better and make Australia cleverer.
Almost every Nobel laureate in my lifetime has used the prize to transform themselves from a scientist into a public intellectual. And, of course, Einstein himself spent his latter years getting involved in the big political issues and the big discussions of his day. It's no bad thing, though, is it?
It is and it isn't. If any of you watched the press conference on Wednesday morning when Brian Schmidt was speaking, first he was asked how he felt and how he found out and what he discovered, and then immediately they said, well, what's your thoughts on a carbon tax? And, you know, as an astronomer, my immediate reaction is like run away from that question as fast as possible. I know my galaxies and my stars, don't get me bogged down in these things. But I think the reality is that scientists do have a responsibility to provide a voice, an opinion. Scientists don't set policy, but they should be providing guidance and advice on the many complex issues which science bears on. So I think it's great that some scientists are prepared to step out of the lab and help people understand that it's not just whoever's the most shrill who's right, but that there is a scientific approach that provides lots of answers.
Coming back to what you were saying before about theory, measurement, evidence, it's interesting that Brian's discovery, co-discovery, went against what he believed to be the case.
That's right, and that's one of the things about science. Sometimes someone sets out to do something and they say, if we can pull this off, we're going to win a Nobel Prize. And there's many examples of prize winners who knew what they were getting themselves in for. But what Brian and his colleagues were doing was something, I wouldn't say far more mundane, but certainly a little bit more mundane, is they were just trying to nail down more tightly how fast the universe was expanding, which would have been a useful, well-regarded measurement, but would not have been Nobel Prize-winning stuff. And they found, to their horror, that their measurements were way off the chart. They weren't where they were supposed to be. They obviously considered the possibility that they had screwed up colossally. But they were so careful in their measurements. And when they started to hear whispers that their competing team were finding the same thing, they started to realize that they had stumbled across something totally unexpected. And that's that the universe wasn't slowing down, but it was speeding up. And so you've got to keep an open mind in science. Winning a Nobel Prize is a lot about being at the right place at the right time, but it's also about realizing when you're in the right place at the right time. There's many other people who have made similar discoveries but have just shoved it aside because it wasn't quite what they wanted to do or what they were looking for, and they've not paid enough attention to it.
Hello. Being fairly new to science, I've just started studying a Bachelor of Science. And as a first-year course, we are taught science communications. And I was wondering how, in this age where scientists get vilified, we saw that with the German climate scientist in Melbourne being shown a hangman's noose in a public lecture, how the importance of scientists themselves being in the public arena rather than science journalists.
Well, first, you said you're doing a Bachelor of Science degree. Well, I was amazed by the fact that you just sort of said routinely, as if, of course I know this, that you have to do science communications as part of your degree, because nothing like that was ever offered to me, and I think that's a really good thing that you have to or encourage to take such a course. What university are you enrolled at? Well, I'd say props to them for offering that course, because I think it's absolutely critical that scientists are good communicators. I remember being sort of directed when I was at high school saying, well, if you're good at English, you go into journalism or law, but if you're bad at English and good at maths, you should do science. And I think it's really a bit of an eye-opener for students who are no good at English when they roll up to their science degree and discover that you have to be able to write and speak and communicate just as much as in any other profession. Most scientists, including myself in Australia, are being paid by the taxpayer, by you. Thank you for paying my salary. And so I think it's really important that we get out of the lab and not worry about getting that next paper out as quickly as otherwise and telling people what we're doing. Because if you don't think what we're doing is worth doing, then you've got to ask, well, should we be doing it? So I think the scientists, whether they're good communicators or not, really do need to be telling people what they're doing. It doesn't have to be shrouded in mystery or complicated mathematics. But I think people need to understand what Australian scientists do and why we do it. When I was growing up, I didn't even know we had scientists in Australia. I thought that was something you had in, you know, the US. And I was sort of amazed as I got older that we really did actually have scientists. So I think the media have a crucial role to play in promoting success stories of Australian science. And I think scientists have a role to play in getting out there and telling people what they do. Now, obviously, there is a dark side to this in that if you're prepared to stand up on a stage, you do open yourself up for attacks. But I think the more scientists are out there trying to present what they do in a way that demonstrates that they're generally just interested in understanding things and that there's often normally not an agenda, is the best way to help the public understand the sorts of input we can provide to the debate.
But given the interconnectedness of almost everything, does that not mean that from time to time a scientist will have to answer the question about what he thinks, he or she thinks about a carbon tax?
Yeah, and while no scientist wants to answer that question because they're playing a role where they're not elected to promote policy, I think the reality is you do have to get up there and say these things, and people might not like your answer. You also will sometimes have to give an opinion, even though our scientific training repeatedly tells us it's not about your opinion, it's about the measurements. But I think that people have to understand on things like climate change that it's not just, well, there's opinions on one side and there's opinions on the other, but that there is an overwhelming scientific consensus in favour of human-made climate change, and that the alternative is not just a he says, she says thing, but it's a fringe view that isn't supported by the evidence. So I think that people do have to put it out there and tell them how scientists think and what they believe, because otherwise, as I said, whoever yells the loudest tends to win the argument.
Well, take some consolation from the fact that I reckon I must have interviewed well over 1,000 scientists in the last few decades on a plethora of disciplines and from every known university in the galaxy, and overwhelmingly articulate. You know, there are now so many fine science writers as well who've got good, you know, substantial academic credentials but have become village explainers. It's not hard now to find a scientist who can articulate.
Yeah, I have to say I think science journalism in Australia has gotten so much better over the last 20 or 30 years. There are most of the big newspapers now have a science section and a set of science journalists who understand the issues and can write about them intelligently. There's some excellent science reporting on the radio. We have good science magazines like Cosmos. I guess the one area I think we're still lagging is a bit in TV. I mean, we have Catalyst and we have Scope, but you know that's a very small part of the number of hours that are on TV each week. So I think the media are actually complicit in a positive sense in the change, in that you can get a phone call from a journalist now and be less afraid that they're just going to completely screw things up or dumb down the story, and that you're talking to journalists who understand what the issues are and they know how to translate it.
I heard you use the word believe. Could you tell me why science uses the word believe? Because I really wish they wouldn't. I mean, if you read the Catholic Encyclopedia, it's defined as the state of the mind, that's not based on intrinsic evidence but on authority. So could we invent a new word?
One of the battles between science and more general discourse is the limitations of language, in that when a scientist uses a word like believe or theory, we sometimes use it scientifically and sometimes we don't. Now, if I'm writing a scientific paper, I will never use the word believe. At least I think I can say that, because obviously believe suggests some sort of opinion that other person might differ on and I might change my mind later. So you're very careful to use words that have an objective, precise meaning. But we're human beings. There's a joke about, you know, the space-time theorist who can't explain it because he doesn't have the time. You know, we use these words in different senses. When I use the word theory in a scientific sense, it means something very different. I mean, gravity is a theory, right? But it's, you know, no climate change denier is going to suggest that gravity isn't a good theory. So I think we have to be careful with our language. But if we talk in terms of theories and postulates and so on, then that's not a very engaging way to communicate with the public. We have to adjust our language. And so words like believe, which I agree suggests something not very scientific, often pop up. So, you know, I'm often asked if I believe in UFOs or if I believe in life on other planets. And, you know, I have to give quite a long answer that separates my own personal spiritual beliefs from what the scientific evidence provides.
I've got to jump on that. A spiritual belief? Now tell me.
Oh, man, I shouldn't have said that. Well, I think that a lot of people set religion and science up as these incompatible things, and that you're either religious or you're a scientist, and you certainly can't be both. But I certainly have personal religious beliefs, and they don't create, in my mind, don't create any conflict with my scientific work. My science has nothing to say about religion, and in my opinion, there's that believe idea again. You know, I believe that the religious side of things has nothing to say about the science. So they're no more in conflict than following cricket in the summer and footy in the winter to me. Other people feel very differently from that. I have been to the Creation Museum in Cincinnati, and that's quite an eye-opener. I suggest any of you ever in that part of the world go to there, which suggests, obviously, that religion and science are either directly at conflict or that one is very prescriptive of the other. But my own personal view is that you can believe in a creator and a story and a purpose for the universe, and that in no way affects the measurements of the temperatures of stars or the rotation periods of galaxies and so on.
Well, in that regard, you, of course, are at one with my old friend Paul Davies, who also has a conviction that there is a God, not one that any of the religions on Earth would be comfortable with, but he shares that view that there's... and, of course, many others disagree with it passionately, and it's the ongoing argument. But you can win a Templeton Prize in due course, which goes, as you know, to someone who has both made a contribution to science and religion. And I think we've interviewed just about every Templeton Prize winner for the last 20 years. The thing I find interesting about some of them is that their religious belief is essentially quite simple. It's almost a Sunday school religion that hasn't been modified by their science. And I'm very uneasy with that. That just strikes me as nonsensical not to apply the same scientific principles. My friend Barry Jones, when I put this to Barry, I say, Barry, how can you simultaneously believe in life after death, you know, Jesus, etc., and at the same time have such a passionate belief in the scientific method? And he always looks a bit sort of like a rabbit caught in the headlights, but he just says different hemispheres. And there's some truth in that.
Well, yeah, I mean, obviously you have a very different belief system, which is well known in this regard. So a question for you might first be, how do you explain that such smart people can perhaps be so misguided?
But I don't have that problem. I never have. I'm not a Dawkins or a Hitchens atheist. I've always understood the religious impulse, the yearnings. I tried to believe, you know, when I was a child. And I also recognise that science and religion have been a double act, you know, for thousands of years. And to pretend that they haven't been or that they weren't is a nonsense. So I don't have a conflict
right
there.
Okay. Well, it's funny that you said you tried to believe, because I actually tried not to believe. Mm. And that, you know, as a teenager, I was showing a bent towards science, and I sort of said, well, I must apply my scientific principles to everything. And it was clear that, you know, a God, a creator, had no place in this. So I sort of said, you know, the stereotype that scientists must be atheists. And so I sort of concluded that was the best path for me. But despite that scientific leaning that you're alluding to, I found that it just... the other hemisphere, if you like, just said, well, this doesn't make sense. And it was really the astronomy that helps me, that for me provides the evidence for a greater power, and that the universe is so damn simple. It's just a few simple rules. Like, it's basically three or four simple mathematical rules, and you get so much wondrous complexity and amazing things happen. And I'm not going to say it couldn't have happened randomly, because that's part of the beauty of it. It has happened randomly, and it's been set up in a way such that randomness can produce all this structure. So I do have this sort of Sunday school God view of it, if you like, that I don't really believe that God is making sure that one football team beats another football team, as a lot of players who seem to win man of the match sort of invoke God for helping them. I can't really believe in that sort of creator that really has a day-to-day role in human affairs, but certainly someone who set things up and is keeping things running. The blind watchmaker that's been coined, to me, is actually quite appealing personally.
I would ask you this. Given what Brian got the Nobel Prize for, given the fact that the universe expands faster and faster and faster and finally becomes a great null void, does that not disturb your sense of a religious purpose if it all finishes up dead?
Not really. I think from a religious perspective, what was disturbing was cosmology, say, 60 or 70 years ago, which was the universe is basically unchanging, or say 100 years ago. The universe was unchanging, it always was and always will be. In the 1920, 1930, people found evidence for a Big Bang, that the universe had a very discrete beginning, and I'm sure that was very satisfying to a lot of people who liked the Genesis description. And by the same token, I think that the alternative, that the universe might slow down and collapse and then just begin again, suggests that even our own universe is not special or has any purpose or reason. And the idea that it had a finite beginning and then it will run its course, like a computer program that you start and then when it's finished doing what it's designed to do, it ends. Not that my opinion really matters to the universe, but to me it is sort of satisfying that there is a beginning and an end, and we're part of that journey.
Can the theory of God be subjected to test, or is it like string theory?
I think that's a really good analogy, actually. And the thing is that if science cannot prove one way or the other if God exists, then that tells you that it just comes down to what you believe.
All those in favour of God say aye. No, please. That's not... Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Glad you came.
Thanks for your question.
Thanks for coming. Well, that was a fragment from a chat I had with Brian Gensler at the Adelaide Festival of Ideas. Brian's an award-winning astronomer, author, science communicator, and amongst his many credentials, a former Young Australian of the Year. And that's a wrap from Adelaide and from the festival. And that's it for another week of LNL. Oh, except for Classic, of course. And thank you to the team. Chris Short, Paul Goff, Gail Basario, Kate McDonald. Gail and Kate travelled with me to Adelaide to put all this together. And now it's time to listen to the news on Radio National, and we'll see you next week.